And welcome everyone to an extremely special episode of Podcast Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course I'm joined by my partner in cinematic crime, Frank. What's going on, buddy?
How's it going, man? I'm very much looking forward to this one. This is going to be special.
Yeah, I know I'm speaking for the both of us when I say how truly excited we are for tonight's chat. We've been honored to be joined by the esteemed director, screenwriter, and cinematographer, Peter Hyams, who's extremely well-known for the science fiction thriller Outland with Sean Connery, as well as the Connery thriller The Presidio, Capricorn One, 2010, The Year We Make Contact, Running Scared with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal, The Star Chamber with Michael Douglas, Time Cop and Sudden Death, which are easily two of Jean-Claude Van Damme's best movies, horror thriller and audience favorite The Relic, which I can still remember seeing opening night like it was yesterday, the cult classic Stay Tuned with John Ritter, which Frank and I are just massive fans of, and the Arnold Schwarzenegger versus the Devil Showdown, End of Days. I know I can't wait to talk to you about one of his first efforts, the very influential cop film Busting with Elliot Gould and Robert Blake. I'm just a massive fan of it. And Peter's had a tremendous career. We're both super excited, so we're going to jump right into it. Welcome to the show, Peter. Thanks a lot, man.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So I just want to jump right in, because as soon as I knew we were going to have you on, I couldn't wait to ask you about this, and I'm sure you've been asked about this many, many times throughout your career.
Why don't you stop saying you're going to jump right in and jump right in?
Okay. 2010. What was it? How did you get involved in the sequel to one of the greatest movies ever made?
The studio MGM asked me to do it. I did not want to do it. The guy who was the man who was the chairman of the studio, Frankie Blondes, I had made a film called Star Chamber with Frank as the producer, and then he became chairman of MGM, and he kind of came after me to do it, and I found it very difficult to resist. The obvious drawback being, firstly, you know, it was based on a book,
right,
that Arthur Clarke wrote, so it's not like it was my idea. Obviously, I did not want to be compared to Stanley Kubrick. It's kind of ridiculous. Comparing me to Stanley Kubrick is, you know, comparing a fat, you know, it's like a mouse to an elephant. So my first rule was I had to be approved by Stanley Kubrick and approved by Arthur Clarke. And my second thing was the book that Arthur wrote was about Russians and Americans going on this mission together, and everybody's happy and everybody's, you know, everything's fine. I mean, I always remember lines like, "Why, Dmitri, you old Cossack," stuff like that, which, you know, I couldn't do. And I come from a blacklisted family, and this was during the Reagan administration. And I said, there's something interesting to do if you have Russians and Americans go up on this rather epic voyage and have all hell break loose, have the Cold War get worse and worse and worse, while these two groups are together, and what would the ramifications be? So when I spoke to Arthur Clarke, I said, if you want me to do this movie, I'm going to make a very big change, and you have to approve that, and you have to approve my kind of West Side of New York wise-ass dialogue, because that's what's going to come out. That's what's going to come out of me. And Arthur was very gracious and said, yes, no, and I love the idea. So I said, fine. So the next thing was to be approved by Kubrick. I was in my office at MGM, and the phone call, which had been arranged, like 12 o'clock, and my assistant said, Stanley Kubrick's on the phone. And I grabbed the phone, and I stood up. I did most of the phone call while I was standing up. And I said, hi, how do you do, Mr. Kubrick? And the first thing out of his mouth was, he said, hi, Peter. and you don't expect a kind of Brooklyn accent, Bronx accent out of Stanley Kubrick. Very soft-spoken with this real New York accent. And the first thing he said was, "Hi, Peter, in Outland when you did," and he started mentioning shots. And he was asking me how I did them. And then we began to talk about photography. And as it turns out that, like me, he was a photographer, and he couldn't get into the union in England. But, you know, he made his own lenses. He did these amazing things. And we talked and talked and talked and talked. And finally, I said to him, "Listen, they've asked me to do 2010. Do you approve me?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, of course," and then went on. And when we got to the end of the phone call, he said to me, "Remember, make your own movie." And he hung up. And it was very sweet. And my assistant came running in, and he said, "Well, what's it like?" I said, "Well, we spoke for 2 hours, 3 hours." I told him everything, and he told me nothing.
Oh.
And then about 6 months later, I was sitting with Arthur Clark, and I said, "Arthur, what was it like the first time you met Stanley?" He said, "Oh, I won't forget it. We spoke for 2 or 3 hours, and I told him everything, and he told me nothing."
Oh, wow.
So I just said about making a film that was so different in texture and sound and sight, and it just didn't look, smell, or feel like the original, like 2001. That was so different that you couldn't really compare them. I mean, you could like one more than the other, except you couldn't compare them. I thought, and that's what was so smart about what Kubrick said. If I tried to make a film that was like his, I would be compared.
Yeah, I recently watched that again today. I've been a fan of it over the years, and I think it's fabulous, and I think you're absolutely right. I don't think it could be any different from 2001. I think people forget that there's four books that Arthur C. Clarke wrote, and they viewed that film as a direct sequel to 2001. One thing you brought up was when you mentioned the wise-ass Brooklyn in your screenwriting in the film.
I didn't say Brooklyn. I said West Side of New York.
West Side of New York, I'm sorry. Is that part of the reason why you cast Roy Scheider in the lead?
No.
Because he's long been one of my favorite actors. I
was crazy about Roy Scheider. And I thought there was a believability about Scheider, and I thought there was an accessibility about him. And 2001, being this kind of landmark film that it is for almost anybody who loves film, was also very cold, not very talky, and a little undecipherable. And so I wanted to populate this film with people who are so accessible. So it was, you know, it was Roy, and it was John Lithgow, and Bobby Balaban, and of course Alan Mirren, and it's just the way I write and how I wanted the movie to be so different. I wanted to put just people of real texture.
Yeah, the cast is great. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, one of the biggest things about your career, and I know a lot of people have noticed, something I pay attention to is that you served as your own cinematographer, which is just an amazing thing to even consider on some of this, you know, the scale of some of these movies that you worked on. Can you talk a little bit about what it, you know, what it was like to, you know, work as your own cinematographer and the challenges that that may or may not have presented to you as a filmmaker?
Yeah. The biggest challenge was the union didn't want to allow me to do it, and they tried to stop me from doing it. They even at one point sued. It took a long time for me to become a union cinematographer. It's actually easier for me. And the only analogy that I can give a lot of times, because every time a film opens and you have to do these press interviews, that always ask the same question. How do you manage to wear so many hats? And I say, in the first place, I'm bald, so it's easy. I said, and secondly, if you were fluent in Japanese and you were working in Tokyo, would it be easier for you to have an interpreter? Or would you just tell the person across the table what you wanted to tell them? I was an art student from the time I was 6 years old, and I studied photography. I studied monorail photography. I studied chamfer techniques. I worked for a photographer, still a photographer. I worked with plate cameras. As a matter of fact, all the plates, all the stills for the plates on Outland was from my with my camera, which is with a 4x5 Linhof. When you're making a film, at least in my case, you see it. You see it. And most people who direct films try to come as close to what they see as possible. So to me, it's just easier. Most film directors, when they are waiting for the set to be lit, are really not involved in these great Stanislavskian discussions with actors. They're in their trailer. They're on the phone with their agents. They're sleeping. You know, I just don't sit down. The crew likes it because it's one voice. Actors like it because they know you're trying to make them look great. It's a lot of work in some ways, but in some ways it's not. I have great advantages because I'm also directing the film. So I can choose locations and scout locations, and I know exactly where to put the scissor lifts. I know exactly where to put the what size lights, you know, if I'm going to use 18Ks and put them over there. So a lot of it's done before I even get there because I've told the gaffer exactly what I want. Somebody read something on the IMDb or whatever that thing is and wrote about me that I'm known for using natural light. And I remember saying to the person, where the fuck do you find natural light on the soundstage? That's all I can say. I draw before I shoot, and I like the way I draw.
That's fantastic. One quick question before I move on. I know Nick's going to want to bring a film up to you. Have you ever been approached about making another Arthur C. Clarke?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Adaptation?
Oh, yeah. Martha called me.
Did he?
Yeah. It was the next one. It was 2030 something or something like that. That was the next book he wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah. No,
and then you.
One. No. Once was enough.
Once was enough. Okay. Yeah. Cool. I think they've been trying to get 3001, which is the last one, off the ground for a while, and I don't think anybody's wanted to make it. So I was curious to see if they had come to you.
Yeah, our author came to me when he wrote the book. He sent me the book. No, I mean, I got out alive and I didn't want to do it again.
Did Kubrick ever talk to you after the film's release?
Yeah, he was very kind. He was
awesome.
He was very kind.
Well, it's amazing it's just, you know, it's one of the most iconic movies, and, you know, everybody has the right to tell the story that they want to tell. It's amazing to hear the seeming graciousness of somebody like Kubrick, who, you know, has this aura about him as a filmmaker for everybody. And
I don't know if anybody has ever worked with him who has described him as being anything other than he was a very sweet guy. And I think everybody who worked with him describes him as that. Surprisingly open, surprisingly gracious. Just, you know, the tenacity of him of trying to get what he wanted exactly the way he wanted. I mean, all those things were real. He is also just very sweet.
One of your first features, one of your early credits, I should say, is a movie that I just absolutely love. It's Busting. And I think one of the most exciting things about watching that movie now is how it clearly sort of set a template that would be followed in the 80s for the, you know, the buddy cop formula, you know, genre type movie. And, you know, same year, I believe, that Busting came out, Freebie and the Bean came out, and those movies for me sort of like jump-started that, you know, milieu of action films. And what was it like working on Busting? And I really want to specifically ask, how were the shots inside of the hallway during that chase sequence? How were all of those shots created pre-Steadicam? Because there's camera moves.
There are two ways. One was like those shots in the hall, I think, where it was a wheelchair, a handheld camera with a wheelchair.
So smooth.
Yeah, because you kind of hug it.
And it was like, so
there is a very, very elaborate shot in a market.
Yeah, the market.
And that was dolly track that was laid. I mean, really complicated dolly track that was laid. If you are a responsible filmmaker, if you actually believe that you actually give your word to a studio and say, I got Busting was 35 days, and you give your word that you're going to make it in 35 days, you have to keep your word, I think, just because you gave your word. So you take each day and you say, all right, I got $10 to spend this day. I'm going to spend $8 on this shot, and I'll do everything else for $2. And there is one very long shot that goes up and down in the Grand Central Market that was we built it.
Yeah,
I've only delivered two moments of really good directing in my life. I made a picture with Michael Caine and Natalie Wood that was retitled People. It was originally called Fat Chance, and spent a lot of time building this very long dolly shot late in the day. Crew's getting tired, and Natalie, who was just such a terrific lady, we went and got her, and I said, Nat, okay, you start here, and you go all the way to here, and you turn and say your line. And she said, well, what's my motivation for turning here? And the crew kind of went, oh, fuck. And I looked at her, and I said, that's all the track we have. If you keep on walking, you'll be out of the shot. And Natalie, being Natalie, said, I think I feel it. And we went and did the shot. And the only other thing I ever said to an actor I thought was good was I made a film called Star Chamber, and Hal Holbrook, who was one of my favorite actors in the world, it was his first day of shooting. And he came to me and he, you know, I had written very long speeches for Hal and Capricorn One. I mean, he's just fabulous. And he came to me and he said, I'm having trouble. I don't know how to do this scene. And I looked at him and I said, well, just be a little more Jewish. He said, I got it. That was it.
Oh, that's awesome. How did you come about the project of Outland?
I wanted to do a Western. And this terrific man, Richard Ross, who I had made a film with before, and we wanted to work together again. And I said, I want to do a Western. And, you know, I want to write a Western. And Richard said, you won't be able to sell. Nobody will want it. Nobody makes Westerns. And I remember going home feeling depressed, and then I woke up like in the middle of the night and went, wait a second. The Western is not dead. It's alive and well. It just happens to be in outer space. So I wrote Outland.
How did you cast the two heavyweights of Connery and Peter Boyle?
Yeah, and what was it like working with Connery?
Well, I made two pictures with Sean.
Yeah.
I you know, he is he's fabulous. He's totally, totally honest. He cannot stand guile. So if you ever try to be guileful with Sean, he'll kill you. And he's a movie star. I mean, he looks like a movie star. He talks like a movie star. He's just bigger than life. He can be very funny. He's always prepared. He is very happy for somebody else to shine in a scene. He was just one of my favorite people in the world. I can't say enough. And it took a while for him to stop calling me boy. He'd say hi, good morning, boy. Good morning, boy. I kind of knew what that meant. And then. When you tell someone like Connery that you're going to be the one shooting the movie, they kind of say, yeah, and then nod. He didn't believe it. And the first day of shooting involved a very, very long shot that started with Sean almost full body and wound up in a choker close-up. And it was a very involved shot. And if I do say so myself, he looked absolutely stunning in the shot. And you could see he was a little uncomfortable because there was nobody else. It was me. And I had a 20-watt bulb on a string, and I was standing to the left of the camera with the string and the light. And he said, what's that for, boy? I said, well, the camera left side of your face is going to be in shadow. And this string is not going to light you except it will catch a pin spot in your eye. So when the shadow side of your face, there'll be this pin spot for your eye. And he just went, and we did the scene, and we did the shot, and then we did the rest of the day's work. And he came on the set early in the morning the next day, and he said, I'd like to see Daly's boy. And I said, well, you know, I could run it at lunch for you, or we normally do it at the end of the day. I'd like to see them now, boy. Okay. And I call the editor, brilliant editor named Stuart Baird, and who also went on to direct some films. And brilliant editor. And I called Stuart, and I said, Stuart himself wants to see, he's on his way over, and he wants to see Daly now. So Stuart said, really? I said, yeah. And he ran the dailies. Sean came back on the stage. Didn't say a word. Didn't say I liked him, I didn't like him. Didn't say anything. He kind of looked at me a little bit. And we went on to do the thing I had set up. And he turned to me and he said, where's your light bulb, boy? And that was his way of saying it was okay.
That's fabulous. What was it like working with Peter Boyle?
Peter was, terrific. The first thing I had ever written was a picture that I had produced, and a big director at the time named Herbert Ross directed, and it starred Candy Bergen and Jimmy Kahn and Peter. So I had known Peter. And, you know, he's very funny. He was in Second City. He came from that. And I thought he had never done anything like this. And I thought it'd be interesting to put him in it. But plus he was just very good.
Yeah, he was fantastic opposite Connery.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful pairing.
And it's amazing when you look over your resume, the big stars that you've had a chance to work with. It like the list is endless. I mean, you got a chance to work with Harrison Ford on Hanover Street in the middle of the Star Wars craze. And what was it like working with Harrison Ford? I mean, Leslie Ann Down, Christopher Plummer. I'd be curious to know what it was like to work with Harrison Ford.
Oh, I loved Harrison. He was young. He was, just the rocket ship was just starting to take off.
Yeah.
And he worked hard. And the thing about Harrison, you see glimpses of it in the work he's done. The thing that people don't understand about Harrison is he's truly, truly pratfall funny. And he's just, I haven't had bad experiences working with people. I mean, I love actors, and most of them are really, really, really interesting people. And the Michael Douglases of the world, the Sean Connerys of the world. There's a reason why they're stars, because they just have something really interesting about them. Michael's socially and politically very involved. Harrison is, very, very involved in ecology and trying to save the planet. Sean is very involved with actually trying to get Scotland to be independent. I mean, they're people who are, their lives are not just sitting down reading the trades. They're just, they're interesting people. I just adore actors.
Well, it's obvious because you worked with multiple people more than once. So it clearly demonstrates, level of trust between artists. And, this is just a random weird question, but, when you're looking at the credits for Hanover Street, some of the last names of the characters.
Yes.
Cimino, Lucas, and Giller. Are those references to David Giler, George Lucas, and Michael Cimino?
Yes.
And Trumbo.
Love it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fine. I just had to ask. It's wonderful. And the other thing too, not only did you shoot all your movies, you wrote them it's like, it's unbelievable. Like, I just, like, there's so few people that have done what you did, which was to shoot.
Have you seen a television series called The Nick?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's one of the top shows.
Soderbergh wrote, directed, and photographed every single episode.
Oh yeah, it's a remarkable achievement.
Well, you know, it's just making something. It was funny. Steven Soderbergh, we were talking one day, and he referred to he and I as the committee of two, because we're both cinematographers. I also think now things are going to change, to be honest with you, because of digital. Because now you can't bullshit a director the way you could before by saying, it's, you know, don't worry, it'll look perfect in dailies. Because now the director can go and look at a 4K screen and see exactly what it's going to be. And I just think you'll see more of this. That's all.
Of directors shooting their own stuff.
Yeah.
And having more creative control over it.
Sure. It's demystifying it. Because you can see it. I mean, I've never gotten over looking at dailies and having an operator say to me, boy, that looks great. And I go, well, you were there, for God's sakes. You knew what it looked. I mean, how could you not know exactly what it's going to look like? I just think, look, I've had on my wall a quote from Sir Carol Reed, who I hope you know, he was one of our great directors, not one of ours, actually, he was English, the Third Man and all that stuff. He did Oliver. And the quote says, making a film is all work and all worry, all fear and all heartache. Not making a film is worse. So that's what it is. And to me, making a film is the process of failing. It's just you're constantly trying to make it better. And it can never be as good as the movie that's in my head, because it's got to pass through me. And I'm the thing that's between. The only thing that stands between me and greatness is greatness. So the only thing that stands between a film that I make and greatness is me.
It's probably the best way to approach any movie project, I would imagine, because you're probably constantly always trying to prove to yourself that you can do what it is that you've written and thought about. And
it always falls short.
So one of the things you always hear people, filmmakers, say, they always say, I wish I'd done this, I wish I did that. If I did it now again, I would change it. And as an artist, I would imagine that would be something that you would constantly think about.
Yeah, I mean, when we previewed Outland, it was in Texas, and I flew back with Alan Ladd, because it was for the Ladd Company at Warner's. And Laddie was great, said to me, I really would like to make your next film. And I said, well, that's terrific. I know what I want to do. And he said, what? I said, Outland. I know how to do it now. And I wasn't kidding. If they had said yes, I would have made the whole film again. I can't look. That's why I've never looked at a film of mine once I'm done.
Oh wow!
You never watch your movies once you're done. Not once.
No, too painful.
So it's the experience of making it. Do you,
Well, you see it, you know, you see it 1,000 times when you're cutting it.
Exactly.
You
don't sit down ever once to see a finished product cut, sound lock, the whole deal.
Well, I've never looked at a film where I can't make it better. Make it louder, make it softer, make it bluer, make it greener, make it, you know, get rid of this line. If I can't do anything to make it better, I can't watch it.
Gotcha.
I was in London when Capricorn One opened in here, and
it was a hit,
and I came back a week later. I was shooting Anniversary Night. I didn't finish till the week after the film opened, and here in California in Westwood, which is where UCLA is. Where the good films opened, where the big films opened. And this was at a time when, you know, a film did not open in 4,000 theaters. It opened in, I don't know, 1-2 theaters in a city. And so there were lines around the block. And I walked into the lobby of the theater, and I said, could I speak to the manager? And this guy came over, and I introduced myself, and he went, oh, I said, could I just stay in the back and just watch the film? And he said, sure. And I stood in the back, and there's something about a film when it's going to be a hit that the audience wills it to be a hit. They make it a hit because they want it to be a hit. I have no idea why. And when I saw the line and saw the excitement of people crowding into the theater, I remember going, man, I'm pretty hot stuff. And the lights went down and the audience cheered and the Warner Brothers logo came on and they cheered. And I went, oh God, I'm really good. I'm really quite wonderful. And then the film came on and I was looking at it, and about 5 minutes in, I went, oh, if they know I'm in the theater, they're going to tear me to pieces. This is, you know, and I ran out of the theater, and I ran home. We lived at that time in Westwood. And I kind of ran home, closed the door, put my back against the door, had this image of the audience coming out of the theater and coming up my street holding torches like, you know, out of the original Frankenstein movie. I just thought, I said, I'm going to get caught. They're going to just find out what a fraud I am. And I just never, like, I just can't, I've never seen anything I've ever done since.
Well, it's Capricorn One's one of those movies I still can't believe hasn't been remade, given that Hollywood just loves to remake everything.
They were talking about doing it.
Yeah,
for the
it's
past
been talked
few
about.
Years.
I just can't believe it's they haven't pulled the trigger. It's just such, it's a timeless idea. People still talk about that. You know, the notion of the fake landing, and you know that your film combined like the parallax view and science fiction.
That's a wonderful film.
Yes, it is.
One of my absolute favorites. And it's funny, in the start, and I want to just quickly jump to Star Chamber really quick. Frank and I are huge fans of David Fincher's The Game. The Star Chamber feels like a precursor to The Game. I mean, it's amazing. Those guys must have been huge fans of The Star Chamber when they were younger. I think Ferris and Brancato who wrote it.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it was, but in any event, it just the influential nature of that movie of the Star Chamber feels like it really did, you know, serve as a precedent for a lot of thrillers that would come out throughout the years. But getting back to Capricorn One, it's just such a great flick, and it's just got a great sense of popcorn entertainment and smarts and a great, you know, cast and everything about it. And it's almost a miracle that it hasn't been remade. How
would I feel? I would not like to see it remade, personally.
You would not like to see it remade?
Yeah.
Is that just your opinion about remakes in general?
No, I don't know anybody who's made a film and poured their life into a film and wants to see somebody else just do it differently. It is what it is. But on the other hand, you know, people have been doing Romeo and Juliet for a long time. So
it's true.
Nick, Nick and I are obsessed with one of your films, more so than others.
You poor guy.
And that film, I know. It was a rough childhood growing up watching this movie constantly, my poor mother. But Stay Tuned is an amazing film.
Oh. Wild.
it's unlike anything I've ever seen before. And still to this day, it's so relevant and funny. How did you come about making that?
And I watched it on a loop when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I read the script and I thought it was terrific. I didn't write it. I thought it was absolutely terrific. And
it's one of the few you didn't write.
Yeah. I campaigned to do it, and they, you know, they finally let me do it. And then I brought in, I cannot remember the guy's name. He was one of the writers of In Living Color. And we did those movies. We did 30 Something to Life, and we did all those kinds of little things that only worked if you know the television series that we were doing. Do you know what I mean?
Is it television you were doing?
No, what I'm saying was that film is peppered with scenes and sequences that were satirizing television series that were on then. And if you don't know those television series, those jokes don't mean much.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I think Wayne's World is ingrained, and to a certain extent, Three's Company, Star Trek. I think people who would watch it now that had never seen it would understand it.
I mean, there's Northern Exposure. There's
right.
30 Something. It's all those things that I don't think people know.
Three Men and Rosemary's Baby is a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Which is hilarious. I rewatched that one again today.
What was it like working with John Ritter on that?
Oh, the dearest guy. Hysterically funny. Really funny. And just a lovely, lovely, lovely guy. I'm trying to think. I didn't really have bad experiences with anybody, and people like Billy Crystal. This is one of my dearest friends in my life. They're just wonderful people. I love actors. Let me give you a clue. You start out with a blank computer screen, or years ago you started out with blank paper, and you write this character. He's your character. You've created him out of nothing. And you put the words in his mouth. The moment you cast that movie, that character isn't yours. Period.
You're giving birth to something that then takes on its own life.
Yes, and you have to understand, it's not your character. It's Billy Crystal. It's Michael Douglas. And if somebody else besides them did it, it would be totally different, saying the same words. And also, directing is, I've always described it as, it's conducting mass myopia. You want, there's an old gag about an actor day player gets a one-day job in The Godfather as a doorman. And sat with some friends, and someone says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm doing The Godfather." And I go, "Oh, really? What's it about?" And the guy says, "It's about this doorman." that's what you want everybody in the film to believe. In Capricorn 1, I was in the midst of setting up a really complicated thing, and Bobby Walden came up to me and said, what if I put Band-Aid on my glasses? And I went, fine, terrific, you know, and basically I didn't even remember it. I just, who gives a shit? And then I'm sitting 6 months later in an editing room, and I'm looking at it, and I'm going, God, what a great idea that was. And that's what you want. You want to be surprised every single day. The saddest days you ever have as a film director, in my opinion, are the days you stumble back to your home or your hotel room having shot what you expected.
So you've thrived on the unexpected.
You want to be surprised. You want them to make it more, to make it better. And good actors always do.
Now, you had a chance to work with, you know, Frank and I are big fans of action films in general and, you know, the whole crop, you know, Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Van Damme, Lundgren, all those guys from that era. You had a chance to work with Schwarzenegger on one of his more unique projects, a movie actually I saw. I can remember seeing it in the theater with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife. What was it like working with Schwarzenegger on End of Days and taking him definitely into a realm that he hadn't been before?
Well, he was very willing to go there. He had actually developed the project with a terrific producer named Armin Bernstein. And Arnold wanted to do that. Arnold wanted to try being... To open some doors into rooms that he hadn't done before. And, you know, this was just not the place where you hit a guy and then, you know, you say the wisecrack on the scene. And it wasn't that kind of film.
Mm-hmm.
So
I didn't drag him.
First of all, you can't drag Arnold Schwarzenegger. I didn't drag him into doing something. He wanted that. He wanted to show some real feeling. He wanted to show some real emotion. He was willing to actually cry. You know, he hadn't done a film in a couple of years because he had a heart operation.
Yep.
And he was very willing. That's all I can say. And religion meant a lot. You know, Maria is. And Arnold are Catholic and involved with the Catholic Church and very friendly, we're friends with the Cardinal and all that stuff. So religion meant a lot to him. And then, you know, I at the end of the, when we were shooting the ending, he lived. And I went, you know, Arnold, let's do one where you die. I think that'll really be much more interesting. And he was willing.
How did you go about casting Gabriel Byrne in that? That's one of my favorite Gabriel Byrne performances.
I can't say other than I was such a big fan of Gabriel Byrne. I loved the Coen Brothers movie that he did.
Yeah, Miller's Crossing.
Miller's Crossing, yeah. I wanted an actor of a you know, a certain age. I didn't want the guy to be too young because I didn't want Arnold to look too old. And first and foremost, I wanted somebody who had such presence. You're not going to deal with Schwarzenegger by being taller or having bigger muscles. You've got to deal with Schwarzenegger by being so formidable in your eyes and in your smarts and in your canniness and being unpredictable and just just having this overused word called magnetism, having that. That's how you battle Schwarzenegger. And so to me, Gabriel was a not that tough a choice.
And then Rod Steiger, how did he become involved in the project?
He had actually been involved in the project before I came on. I came on. And the producer said to me, if you don't like Steiger and you don't like any of these guys, you can replace them. And I went, I'm gonna fire the guy who was Charlie from On the Waterfront. I'm gonna fire him.
Yeah, I imagine firing the pawnbroker would be pretty tough.
Yeah, but we won't even mention Heat of the Night. So, no, I was very happy to have him.
I know we're running out of time with you, and you've been so gracious with us, but I wanted to ask you quickly about your film Sudden Death,
mm-hmm.
and in specific, the casting of Powers Booth, because Powers Booth in that film has always been one of them.
It's the same thing. If you're going to go up against, the muscle guy, you don't do it with muscles.
Yeah.
You do it with presence, and you do it with Powers is just such a wonderful actor, and he's such a big presence.
He's aggressively awesome in Sudden Death, and that movie has, without a doubt, one of the best fights, the one in the kitchen.
Oh, the thing?
That fight.
I just thought that would be very funny.
It's funny, it's inspired, it's nasty, it's drag 'em out nasty. Like, I love it's just, you don't forget that scene. I remember seeing that movie with my dad, actually. We went and saw it opening weekend, and it was just so much fun. I remember, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't one of the producers of that film Howard Baldwin, the old Kurt Whaler owner, the hockey guy?
Yeah, he owned the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Yeah, and he owned Pittsburgh Penguins. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That's definitely one of the better inspired by Die Hard movies, that in that genre, that realm. And to say nothing of Time Cop, you worked with Ron Silver, again, casting, just like, it's in the same vein as Powers Booth, get this great character actor to go up against, the muscles from Brussels.
And somebody who's smart, you have to project a almost dangerous intelligence, and Ron had that, Powers had that, Gabriel has that, just really smart people.
I was going to say, I know we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you real quick about The Relic. Nick and I saw that both on opening night when it came out in theaters, and we both still love it to this day.
Thank you.
Lots of fun. Everybody loves The Relic.
Seriously.
That movie.
I wanted to make a scary movie. I can't say anything other than I wanted to make a scary movie, and I wanted to make a scary movie that wasn't too dumb.
Yeah, and it was actually had personality, and it was unique, and it was different, and it wasn't the same old. So, yeah, I can vividly remember seeing that with a group of friends opening night, and we all had a blast. Yeah, I mean, it goes without saying, Peter. I mean, Frank and I could talk your ear off. This has just been, one of those things that you won't forget. I mean, we grew up with your films, and you've
the only Relic story I can tell you is that this thing that wonderful Stan Winston made that took 100 people to operate and all that stuff was amazingly articulated. The thing weighed like 700 pounds and it had to be wheeled in. And one day the stage door was stuck where they kept them. And I came on and I said, well, where's Cathoga? And they said, well, the door stuck. I said, you mean to tell me this fucker won't come out of his trailer?
Yeah, it's definitely one of the more memorable creatures, and you know, a movie with personality and humor, and it's a good tone. Well,
you're kinder than I deserve. I really appreciate it. It's very nice of you. You have to forgive me. I actually have to go.
No.
Oh, no problem,
Peter. Thank you so much. It is just a blast, and you know, again, really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care. Thank you both.
Okay. Thank you.
Take it easy.
Bye.